Major McCutcheon, reel one. Where were you born, please?
Darjeeling, Bengal, India.
Was that because your father was Indian Army?
No, my father was a doctor, civilian doctor.
Did you have your education in Britain?
Yes.
Whereabouts?
Prep school near Dunfermline, Scotland, and at Fettes, Edinburgh.
Were your father and mother Scots?
My father was Irish. He always insisted on being considered Northern Irish. And my mother was of Scottish descent. Her father, my grandfather, came down from Sutherland for what I might term the tail end of the Highland Clearances. He was the son of a crofter up there. He went to seek his fortune. So I'm half Scot, half Irish, born in India.
Did you go to Sandhurst?
I went to Sandhurst, yes.
When was that?
Finished 1937-38, just finished Cold War.
What did you think of your course there?
The course at Sandhurst?
Yes.
It was, with hindsight, they fell between two stools and the other. Previously, they produced very good Lance Corporals. Later, they produced some academic people who were half in between. It was a transitional phase. It wasn't bad, it was a whole thing. I made a lot of friends, I knew later.
Do you think it prepared you for the war?
Well, not for the war I went into. But it prepared us, well, in a way, gave the grounding for what we had to do later. There was not, we were expected later to have quite a bit of hands-on training when you went to join your first regiment. Taught you what to expect and so on. And that, to me, that was in India.
Where did you go to on completing your Sandhurst course?
I went to the Little Wellington Regiment in Multan in Punjab, India. Like all Indian Army people, you had to do a year with the British Battalion before going to your Indian Regiment.
How did you get on with the Duke of Wellington's?
Really well, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I seriously considered, and I did apply to the main of them, but my year coincided with the outbreak of the war, and the government of India wouldn't tolerate any loss of officers, young officers. Some had in previous years, and there were only two who'd gone out to the British Battalion, as we call it. And subsequently did remain the same, not the Indian Indian Army. But with certain war looming at the outbreak of the war, they said no, you must go to your Indian regiment.
And which was your Indian regiment?
The 4th Royal Rifles, 4th Rifles, 4th of the Reserve.
Where did you join them?
It's a place rather romantically named Lollara in Balochistan, which is halfway between Quetta and the Waziristan border. It is, strictly speaking, a genuine Northwest Frontier place, but not the conventional accepted Northwest Frontier term.
What impression did the 4th Gurkhas make on you when you first joined them?
A very great impression. They just recently come down from active operations in the Razmak Waziristan area, where they've been very successful and had got a lot of very good reports. They were on top of the world really at that time.
Were these operations against the Fakir of EP by any chance?
No. I think he was a bit later. They were mainly, forgotten. There were just many operations against tribesmen and one or two small lashkars of Bhutan.
When did you actually join them?
I joined the 4th, the 2nd 4th, the 2nd Battalion, in September, just on the outbreak of war. That really coincided with my arrival there. My year in India finished with that. I went to say to the Lollara.
What was the caste or community composition of the 2nd, 4th?
100% Gurkha.
But which Which parts of the Gurkhas?
Mother Gurkhas. They were mainly Western. With, obviously, we all went to Easterners, the Limbus and Rais. Generally speaking, they were Mother Gurkhas, which is the Western tribe, and up in the north. With the occasional, what we used to call line boy, that's the Gurkhas of Indian parentage, or Indian birth, rather, not just Indian parentage.
How did you fit in at first?
Well, the regiment had a bit of a tradition of I was standing off, I think rightly, slightly formal to the newly joined soldiers. And then I was a little kipping as bullying, I can't afford any bullying. But, you know, you gradually fitted in. After I did realize you had to be with them for life, unless you chose to go off and do something else during your service. But you're there for life, they really want to know whether they like you or not. And they were slightly formal to start with. We had a very formal adjutant. And there was no sort of Christian name until suddenly one evening he turned around to me and said, well, because I think I should call you Donald. And how long it was, well, first one had been accepted to an extent.
Did you have active service with them on the frontier?
In the context of the Baluchistan, we did go on several columns, and there were peculiar mixtures of training and active service. And we went to fully out a load of ammunition, bullet up the spike, and so on. And we had to take all reasonable precautions. I can't recall, we were never actually attacked on any of those columns, but they were pretty severe, as close to the real thing you could get for training purposes.
Severe in the sense of exertion, you mean?
Of course. Severe in the context of that we had to take all warlike precautions, so to speak, against being shot up or so on.
Were you still in Baluchistan, Northwest Frontier, when the Japanese War started?
This time, we raised our 3rd Battalion, just about a year after I'd been with the 2nd Battalion. And we had to send each battalion, 1st and 2nd, had to send X number of officers, I think 3 or 4 officers each, plus groups of men, drafts of men. And I was one of those selected to go to the 3rd Battalion. And I was with them, again, as it so happens, back in Baluchistan, a place called Chunham, when the Japanese War started.
So this was the 3rd, 4th?
3rd, 4th, yes. That's when I spent the rest of the war. The Chunham had some British significance and some interest, historical interest. It was almost opposite the Afghan fort of Spin Baldock, which was attacked by our 1st Battalion, I believe, at the end of the 3rd Afghan War in 1919. And what our main job there was when we arrived was to assist in the construction of the defences along the Northwest Frontier, the whole of the Northwest Frontier, stretched virtually from, in broad terms, Karachi right through up along the line of the hills, and this is the one near Quetta, called the Kojak Pass, not to be confused with the bald-headed detective. the importance was it was a main railroad into India from Afghanistan, where it was cut off at the end of the Afghan War. Quite a famous tunnel, the Kojak Tunnel was quite a famous place to be defending, and the hill was around it as a pass, which then could be straight onto the plain to Quetta, though we had these defences to look after. And indeed, every form of advice we gave the contractors, and indeed our men were digging on them as well, constructing them. But they were part and parcel. They went on northwest, right up onto the Khyber, I believe. I didn't see much more of them. That was our main job there, and also ordinary training.
So you had a relatively peaceful time on the frontier?
Yes, then we went after a bit. We were getting a bit disgruntled. war was going on, everything was forgotten as outpost of the Empire, literally. And suddenly we were ordered into the liaison proper. We went up to Dundill, which is a place just outside Rosmark, which was a sort of camp, a fortified camp, on the main road from Wana through, not Wana, so much as Bundle through to Rosmark, where we were on road protection duties. And we had one or two minor skirmishes. So the first day we went out there, we had a skirmish.
Can you
up a distance by Tyson.
Can you describe it?
Indeed you will, because my company was shot up. I don't know if you know the landscape around that part of the world, but the camp at Dundill, overlooking a biggish nala, then there's a long plain, and then went up to a small, what they call a nalai, a small pass, down onto the road along another ridge. And we came out of the camp, we deployed, covered from the camp, going across the plain, spread out. As we got around even the tomb, got onto the slope of the nalai, they were shot at. And this brought joy to our mortar platoon. They'd never fired their guns, their mortar than anger before. And they were ordered to open up, and they did very effectively. And that made tremendous effect on my own chat with the real system. The thing was well working within the battalion. Every one or two minor things like that.
Was anybody hit in your platoon?
Yes. One said it was very minor. Very minor wound in the back of his leg, and put a skin through his host up. To his fury, he was seized by the medical orders and shoved in a stretcher and brought back, protesting loudly that he wasn't hurt at all. He wasn't actually, but he was so keen to do their job, he had no chance but to be hurled back.
Do you think you hit any of the Pathans?
The reports say we did, they were very surprised. Because they were pretty aware of the thing, and they knew that new battalions had been sent up there, not only frontier hardened. And they were very surprised at the very quick reaction of our own battalion. But the reason for this was, of course, that we had in our midst, certainly our commanding officer, a very experienced frontier hand, and half the battalion had served at either the 1st or 2nd battalion on the frontier. This is certainly senior NCOs, the government officers, all had. So to that extent, we weren't a new battalion, completely fresh face coming up there.
Which was your platoon, can you remember?
B Company. I can't remember the platoon.
And when was this?
This was 42, it must have been. It was very shortly after that. We were summoned at dead of night, which we were, the message came in that we were to go down south into the centre of India and train for something, didn't specify, all terribly hush-hush. At that time, inevitably, the commanding officer was away. And he was left to the second in command, and myself, very junior officer, I wasn't even an older, but totally inexperienced. He was a very nice guy, but he was a British service chap. They sent some British service officers, what they called middle piece officers, but this was a severe gap in the Indian Army of what they called the middle piece or captain major level, just after the outbreak of war. He had to be filled in. Because they expanded so much, we expanded 100%. So from two battalions to four battalions and a large regimental center. And this took away a lot of the various important people. And these people were sent out to England to reinforce them. Anyhow, we got in the train, not knowing what to do, and the CEO was on leave at the time. At the time, he couldn't come back to us. At the time we got a hold of him, he got onto a train and came back to the frontier. It was impossible, so we met him on the way down. And he climbed on the train at Lahore station and told us we were going into the central provinces to train for jungle warfare. That was all.
Was this the start of the Chindits for you?
Well, it was. We were the second lot of the Chindits, really, was the 77 Brigade, which was Wingate's own brigade in the first Chindit operation, were already coming out. They'd done their time. I think they were already coming out by then. And at that time, as I understand it, the purpose was to train another brigade, the 111th Army Regiment, which was General Montaigne's brigade. And they were going to alternate. One brigade in, one brigade training. And we went down to Central Province, he joined the 111th Brigade, with General Montaigne, who was an ex 4th Gurkha. And his brigade major was John Master, or Jack Master, as we knew him. And we started training then and there. It was very much individual battalion training. We didn't see terribly much of the rest of the brigade, the Cameronians, the 9th Gurkhas, until very much later in our training.
What did the jungle training consist of?
Back into the jungle. And various sort of obvious Boy Scout tricks of making yourself comfortable in the jungle. Patrolling fairly longish marches we did too. And very, I think many with all our acclimatization, because until you've been and done something, you don't really know what you're training for, what type of stuff, what we're supposed to be doing. And we were sort of training to a set, going to a set piece of text. We did various sort of simulated raids on various parts of the country. We crossed several rivers. River crossing exercises were important. And so on. And tucking up then.
How were you supposed to make yourself comfortable in the jungle?
Well, really, the basic things were, as I taught in the Boy Scout handbook, bang a hole in the ground your hips. Praise God to keep your powder dry. had to keep care of sort of things like revolvers, rifles, and small arms, and ammunition to keep it not getting wet. And keep yourself reasonably comfortable.
Where was this training done?
In the central provinces, in and around the place called Dukwan, Babina, really double poor area, sort of around there. Very sort of Margri, jungle book type country. Well, there were a lot of villages, fairly near European in the place, toward that area.
How did the Gurkhas take to this training?
Well, philosophically, this is a Gurkha would take any sort of training, really. I'm not being sort of Gurkha mad over this, but they're very philosophical soldiers, and if this is the only time they did it. Because they're not, contrary to popular belief, they're not forest dwellers themselves. And they had to learn almost as much about it ourselves, indeed, as much as the Japanese had to learn, who were not forest dwellers back in their own home country. The Gurkhas lived in the hills, but not deep in the forest. There weren't any to start off with. And they got used to it. They, you know, quite even more used to it for their virtues. Hardy, resilient people. In some respects, very adaptable. In others, not adaptable. If you go through the various martial races, they all got very similar characteristics in various respects. There is the Gurkha, the Turk, and the Japanese.
In what way were they not very adaptable?
If the fastest thing you see going past is a bullet cart, and you're suddenly faced with a transport, aeroplane and so on, it's a bit of a culture shock, as they say nowadays. But they got over it. And they're great commissioners in many ways. One of the problems with the Indian Army at one time, in the early days of the war, was promoting the most suitable chaps. Because it's very much, or what you say, the civil service, Buggins' term, seniority played a large part in that promotion. And some bright spark invented a scheme by which you sent a bright young boy on a course, and he came back as a Viceroy's commissioned officer. It was a howling failure, because these chaps were just not accepted. I remember meeting one of them. It was a very young worker from, I can't remember which regiment, and he was most self-effacing, he faced himself very well, wouldn't face up to people. I knew somebody in the business. I said, what about this guy? And oh Lord, we didn't understand. And he went on this course, and he'd come out commissioned, vice versa commissioned officer. I said, go officer. And he just doesn't fit in. The men don't respect him. He's not seen enough. He doesn't get on well with the very much older officers in their own mess. It wasn't a great success. So I guess I mean they were traditionalists. They liked the reason to cut and dry, and also they paid great respect to seniority on based on service.
So did the Gurkhas more or less sabotage the scheme by not cooperating with it?
Not just the Gurkhas. I think throughout the Indian Army, I had no experience of it. The only chap I met. And anecdotal evidence was it did not go down well with the rest of the army. In the same way, it took some time for the concept of parachute regiment to form, because the Indian sepoy and the Gurkha riflemen, Gurkha sepoy, for that matter, don't like leaving the regiment. I mean, they're not the same way the British troops would gladly volunteer if called upon for most operations. Is epitomized by one of our better officers saying, if they converted this battalion to a parachute battalion, every man would go, as you leave them. So I don't want to leave this battalion and go and dump somebody else. That's an attitude. And so it took some time for both the parachute and the Indian parachute battalion to really settle down in the corporate home.
Did any accidents occur in the training?
Oh, yes, the odd one. We had one chap who, and here we discover why, he seemed to trip. He was advancing through the jungle, and I was just behind this going on, was only a few yards behind. And suddenly there was a burst of Tommy's submachine gun fire, and a loud shout, and the chap fell down. And there was nobody in front of him, there was no question of firing back, but he appeared to have tripped and fallen and dropped his Tommy gun. And shot himself in the chest. And then we had a...
So it was a fatality?
He eventually died. He died... I don't remember right, but somebody at that time was quite a... not a common occurrence, of course, but not unusual. As a delayed shock, that he'd never really recovered. A few days later, he did die. He got fairly massive wounding, and very near the time at Thompson's submachine gun. They fired heavy lead bullets, which I knew. If you hit one of those, you knew you were hit. And he did too, unfortunately. And the other one I recall was a British officer who was hit by a grenade splinter, a grenade training. I'm not sure, I can't even remember exactly how it happened. But generally speaking, we were fairly careful with the use of arms, again, based on the fact that we had a sufficient number of NCOs and Gurkha officers who had experience of live fire on the frontier, which had been nothing like the 1418 war or later, but it was enough to make them conscious of the fact that, you know, a rifle was a very dangerous thing in the hands of an unskilled chap. So we didn't have, I can't recall, apart from sort of chaps breaking ankles and breaking heads, and one chap who fell into a slip trench at night and broke his thigh. But this could have had them anything, so not just the training.
Did you get any visits by VIPs like Wingate?
Yes, he did. He did visit us. In our training, we got all sorts of people. Honestly, I can't remember half of them who they were. People came down from Delhi. They did a grand job, chaps. Get on with it. Got back on the train back to Delhi. Quite a few of those. Wingate came once or twice, not so much. He was just sort of settling in. Gradually, the force, as they were called, you know, was expanding and expanding, incorporating 70th British Division, which was broken up and turned into separate independent brigades. And he was a fairly busy chap at that time, and he attended some major exercises.
Can you describe him or remember anything, incidents about when he visited?
He looked dead scrubby most of the time. I think he was growing a beard for no very good reason at that stage of proceedings. we weren't really giving, we could easily get shaded as well as they would for something, because we had legends about him and going around with an onion and a chunk of bread in his pocket. He said if he put on a messianic act every now and again, you know, an old man is at least fit.
In what way did he show his messianism?
Well, the high flown dressings and remarks. Because he wasn't a Gurkhali speaker. I don't think he spoke any Indian language. He may have been some Arabic or Jewish for his days in Palestine. I don't know, but he addressed slightly. I can't remember any particular speeches, but he gave the impression that that's very helpful when I was a very junior officer at the time. That he was Moses leading the children of Israel.
Were his speeches peppered with references to the quotation from the Bible?
Not too many, no. He didn't want the Bible passage for us, certainly.
What was morale like by the time you'd finished the jungle training and preparation?
It was quite reasonable. Various major errors were made. I think that, looking back now, for example, in the early days, you fed orphans. Because you only had this in good army, you must get used to it. That sounds all right. But then if you consider living off the emergency rations that the British Army had in those days, it was diabolical. It was sort of biscuits and jaded lump of dates and so on, bully beef and things. Didn't really give you the variety of diet for any length of time. And also there was some peculiar rule, regulation, about giving an antimalarial metrophine to the troops. You only had that in an operational area, I believe, under a reasonable, it's only the top expenditure, including not giving it to everybody. Anyway, it was quite a bit of incipient sickness, and so it's got the medical people all about it. They sent down various medical army medical people, them and the units under training, and we went on to a better scale of rations, and we had cod liver oil, I've been given, that's a thing of school days, really, and anti-malarial pills and things. But apart from that, feeling that you were enjoying, they felt they were training for something, weren't too sure what it was going to be, what it was going to be like, because nobody really had experience of this particular type of warfare, certainly we hadn't.
Can you tell me how you got into Burma, please?
Yes, we were ordered to move from the central provinces by train up to Siraj-Gunj Ghat, which is a crossing of the Ganges, the Brahmaputra road. Into Burma, that's where the operation theatre started. And so we trailed across India in this train, took several days. We then got onto a river steamer and went up until we got to crossing over the marsh a bit, and we crossed over the Silchar Track.